The first deck of the first machine jogged forward its flyboard with the first batch of choir-filled papers, almost human the way it to call attention, doing its level best to speak. That door, too, creaking, asking to be shut. Everything speaks in its own way. Noted churchman, an occasional contributor. The foreman handed back the galley page suddenly, saying, "Wait, where's the Archbishop's letter? It's to be repeated in the telegraph. Where's what's-his-name?" He looked about him, round his loud, unanswering machines. "Monks, sir?" a voice asked from the casting box. "Aye, where's Monks? Monks!" Mr. Bloom took up his cutting. Time to get out. "Then I'll get the design, Mr. Nannetti," he said, "and you'll give it a good place, I know."
"Monks! Yes, sir."
3 months' renewal. Want to get some wind off my chest first. Try it anyhow. Robbie in August. Good idea. Horse show month. Balls Bridge. Tourists over for the show.
"A day, father!"
He walked on through the case room, passing an old man, bowed, spectacled, aproned. Old Monks, the day father. Queer lot of stuff he must have put through his hands in his time. Obituary notices, pubs ads, speeches, divorce suits, found drowned. Nearing the end of his tether now. Sober, serious man, with a bit in the savings bank, I'd say. Wife a good cook and washer, daughter working the machine in the parlour. Plain Jane, no damn nonsense.
"And it was the feast of the Passover."
He stayed in his walk to watch a typesetter neatly distributing type. Reads it backwards first. Quickly he does it. Must require some practice, that. Mangid Kir Tap. Poor Papa with his Haggadah book, reading backwards with his finger to me. Pesach. Next year in Jerusalem. Dear, oh dear. All that long business about that brought us out of the land of Egypt and into the house of bondage. Alleluia. Shema Israel. Adonai. Eloheinu. No, that's the other. Then the 12 brothers, Jacob's sons, and then the lamb and the cat and the dog and the stick and the water and the butcher, and then the angel of death kills the butcher and he kills the ox and the dog kills the cat. Sounds a bit silly till you come to look into it well. Just as it means, but it's everybody eating everyone else. That's what life is, after all. How quickly he does that job. Practice makes perfect, seems to see, with his fingers. Mr. Bloom passed on out of the clanking noises, through the gallery, onto the landing. Now, am I going to tram it out all the way and then catch him out, perhaps? Better phone him up first. Number? Same as Sipran's house. 28. 28, double four.
"Only once more, that soap!"
He went down the house staircase. Who the deuce scrawled all over these walls with matches? Looks as if they did it for a bet. Heavy, greasy smell there always is in those works. Lukewarm glue in Tom's next door when I was there. He took out his handkerchief to dab his nose. Citron lemon. Ah, the soap I put there. Lose it out of that pocket. Putting back his handkerchief, he took out the soap and stowed it away, buttoned into the hip pocket of his trousers. What perfume does your wife use? I could go home still. Tram. Something I forgot. Just to see before dressing. No. Here. No. A sudden screech of laughter came from the Evening Telegraph office. Know who that is. What's up? Pop in a minute to phone. Ned Lambert it is. He entered, softly.
Aaron, green gem of the Silver Sea.
The ghost walks,
Professor McHugh murmured softly, biscuitfully, to the dusty window pane. Mr. Dedalus, staring from the empty fireplace at Ned Lambert's quizzing face, asked of it sourly,
"Agonizing Christ, wouldn't it give you a heartburn in your arse?"
Ned Lambert, seated on the table, read on, "Or again, note the meandering of some purling rill as it babbles on its way, fanned by gentlest zephyrs, though quarrelling with the stony obstacles, to the tumbling waters of Neptune's blue domain, mid mossy banks, played on by the glorious sunlight, or neath the shadows cast o'er its pensive bosom by the overarching leafage of the giants of the forest." "What about that, Simon?" he asked over the fringe of his newspaper. "How's that for a high?"
"Changing his drink," Mr. Dedalus said.
Ned Lambert, laughing, struck the newspaper on his knees, repeating, "The pensive bosom and the over-arsing leavage. Oh, boys, oh, boys."
"And Xenophon looked upon Marathon,"
Mr. Dedalus said, looking again on the fireplace and to the window.
"And Marathon looked on the sea."
"That will do,"
Professor McHugh cried from the window. "I don't want to hear any more of the stuff." He ate off the crescent of water biscuit he had been nibbling, and hungered, made ready to nibble the biscuit in his other hand. Highfalutin stuff, bladder bags. Ned Lambert is taking the day off, has he? Rather upsets a man's day, a funeral does. He has influence, they say. Old Chatterton, the Vice-Chancellor, is his granduncle or his great-granduncle. Close on 90, they say. Sub-leader for his death, written this long time, perhaps. Living to spite them. Might go first himself. Johnny, make room for your uncle. The Right Honourable Hedges Heir Chatterton. Dare say he writes him an odd shaky check or two on gale days. Windfall when he kicks out. Hallelujah.
Just another spasm,
Ned Lambert said.
What is it?
Mr. Bloom asked.
A recently discovered fragment of Cicero's, Professor McHugh answered with pomp of tone. Our lovely land. Short, but to the point.
Whose land? Mr. Bloom said simply. Most pertinent question, the professor said between his chews, with an accent on the whose.
Dan Dawson's land,
Mr. Dedalus said.
Is it his speech last night?
Mr. Bloom asked. Ned Lambert nodded. But listen to this, he said.
The doorknob hit Mr. Bloom in the small of the back as the door was pushed in.
Excuse me,
J.J. O'Molloy said, entering. Mr. Bloom moved nimbly aside. I beg yours, he said.
Good day, Jack. Come in, come in.
Good day. How are you, Dedalus?
Well, and yourself?
J.J. O'Molloy shook his head.
Sad.
Cleverest fellow at the junior bar he used to be. Decline, poor chap. That hectic flush spells finis for a man. Touch and go with him. What's in the wind, I wonder? Money worry.
Or again, if we but climb the serried mountain peaks, you're looking extra.
Is the editor to be seen? J.J. O'Molloy asked, looking towards the inner door.
Very much so, Professor McHugh said. To be seen and heard. He's in his sanctum with Lenehan.
J.J. O'Molloy strolled to the sloping desk and began to turn back the pink pages of the file. Practiced dwindling, and might have been. Losing heart. Gambling. Debts of honour, reaping the whirlwind. Used to get good retainers from D&T Fitzgerald. Their wigs to show their grey matter. Brains on the sleeve like the statue of Glasnevin. Believes he does some literary work for the Express with Gabriel Conroy. Well-read fellow. Miles Crawford began on the Independent. Funny the way those newspaper men veer about when they get wind of a new opening. Weathercocks, hot and cold in the same breath. Wouldn't know which to believe. One story good till you hear the next. Go for one another bald-headed in the papers, and then all blows over. Hail fellow well met the next moment.
Ah, listen to this, for God's sake, Ned Lambert pleaded. Or again, if we but climb the serried mountain peaks.
Bombast,
the professor broke in testily.
Enough of the inflated windbag. Peaks, Ned Lambert went on, towering high on high, to bathe our souls, as it were.
Bathe his lips,
Mr. Dedalus said.
Blessed and eternal God. Yes? Is he taking anything for it?
As 'twere in the peerless panorama of Ireland's portfolio, unmatched, despite their well-praised prototypes in other vaunted prize regions, for very beauty of bosky grove and undulating plain and luscious pasture land of vernal green, steeped in the transcendent, translucent glow of our mild, mysterious Irish twilight.
His native Doric.
The moon, Professor McHugh said. He forgot Hamlet, that mantles the vista far and wide, and wait till the glowing orb of the moon shines forth to irradiate her silver effulgence.
Oh, Mr. Dedalus cried, giving vent to a hopeless groan. Shite and onions! That'll do, Ned. Life is too short.
He took off his silk hat, and blowing out impatiently his bushy moustache, Welsh combed his hair with raking fingers. Ned Lambert tossed the newspaper aside, chuckling with delight. An instant after, a hoarse bark of laughter burst over Professor McHugh's unshaven, black-spectacled face.
"Dowie Daw!" he cried.
"What Weatherup said?"
All very fine to jeer at it now in cold print, but it goes down like hot cake, that stuff. He was in the bakery line, too, wasn't he? Why, they call him Dowie Daw. Feathered his nest well, anyhow. Daughter engaged to that chap in the Inland Revenue Office with a motor. Hooked that nicely. Entertainments, open house, big blowout. Weatherup always said that. Get a grip of them by the stomach. The inner door was opened violently, and a scarlet, beaked face, crested by a comb of feathery hair, thrust itself in. The bold blue eyes stared about them, and the harsh voice asked,
"What is it?"
"And here comes the sham squire himself," Professor McHugh said grandly.
"Get out with that, you bloody old pedagogue,"
the editor said in recognition.
"Come, Ned,"
Mr. Dedalus said, putting on his hat. "I must get a drink after that."
"Drink?" the editor cried. "No drink served before mass."
"Quite right, too,"
Mr. Dedalus said, going out.
"Come on, Ned."
Ned Lambert sidled down from the table. The editor's blue eyes roved towards Mr. Bloom's face, shadowed by a smile.
"Will you join us, Miles?" Ned Lambert asked.
"Memorable battles recalled. North Cork Militia," the editor cried, striding to the mantelpiece. "We won every time. North Cork and Spanish officers."
"Where was that, Miles?"
Ned Lambert asked, with a reflective glance at his toe caps.
"In Ohio,"
the editor shouted.
"So it was, begad,"
Ned Lambert agreed. Passing out, he whispered to J.J. O'Malloy, "Incipient jigs, sad case."
"Ohio!"
the editor crowed in high treble from his uplifted scarlet face.
"My Ohio!"
"A perfect critic," the professor said. "Long, short, and long."
"O harp aeolian!"
He took a reel of dental floss from his waistcoat pocket, and breaking off a piece, twanged it smartly between two and two of his resonant, unwashed teeth. Bing-bang, bing-bang. Mr. Bloom, seeing the coast clear, made for the inner door.
"Just a moment, Mr. Crawford," he said. "I just want to phone about an ad."
He went in.
"What about that leader this evening?"
Professor McHugh asked, coming to the editor and laying a firm hand on his shoulder.
"That'll be all right,"
Miles Crawford said more calmly.
"Never you fret. Hello, Jack. That's all right."
"Good day, Miles,"
J.J. O'Malloy said, letting the pages he held slip limply back on the file.
"Is that Canada swindle case on today?"
The telephone whirred inside. 20, double four, yes.
"Spot the winner!"
Lenehan came out of the inner office with sports tissues.
"Who wants a dead cert for the Gold Cup?" he asked.
"Scepter, with O'Madden up."
He tossed the tissues onto the table. Screams of newsboys barefoot in the hall rushed near, and the door was flung open.
"Hush!" Lenehan said. "I hear feet stoops."
Professor McHugh strode across the room and seized the cringing urchin by the collar as the others scampered out of the hall and down the steps. The tissues rustled up in the draught, floated softly in the air, blue scrawls, and under the table came to earth.
"It wasn't me, sir. It was the big fella shoved me, sir. Throw him out and shut the door,"
the editor said. "There's a hurricane blowing."
Lenehan began to pull the tissues up from the floor, grunting as he stooped twice.
"Waiting for the racing special, sir,"
the newsboy said.
"It was Pat Farrell shoved me, sir."
He pointed to two faces peering in around the door frame.
"Him, sir."
"Out of this with you,"
Professor McHugh said gruffly. He hustled the boy out and banged the door to. J.J. O'Malloy turned the files crackingly over, murmuring, seeking, continued on page 6, column 4.
"Yes, Evening Telegraph here,"
Mr. Bloom phoned from the inner office.
"Is the boss?"
"Yes, Telegraph."
"To where?"
"Aha, which auction rooms?"
"Aha, I see. Right. I'll catch him."
A collision ensues.
The bell whirred again as he rang off. He came in quickly and bumped against Lenehan, who was struggling up with the second tissue.
"Pardon, monsieur,"
Lenehan said, clutching him for an instant and making a grimace.
"My fault," Mr. Bloom said, suffering his grip. "Are you hurt? I'm in a hurry."
"Knee,"
Lenehan said. He made a comic face and whined, rubbing his knee.
"The accumulation of the Anno Domini. Sorry,"
Mr. Bloom said. He went to the door and, holding it ajar, paused. J.J. O'Malloy slapped the heavy pages over. The noise of two shrill voices, a mouth organ, echoed in the bare hallway from the newsboys squatted on the doorsteps.
"We are the boys of Wexford who fought with heart and hand."
"Exit Bloom."
"I'm just running round to Bachelor's Walk," Mr. Bloom said, "about this ad of Keys. Want to fix it up. They tell me he's round there in Dillon's."
He looked indecisively for a moment at their faces. The editor, who, leaning against the mantelshelf, had propped his head on his hand, suddenly stretched forth an arm, amply.
"Begone," he said. "The world is before you."
"Back in no time," Mr. Bloom said, hurrying out.
J.J. O'Malloy took the tissues from Lenehan's hand and read them, blowing them apart gently. Without comment.
"He'll get that advertisement," the professor said,
staring through his black-rimmed spectacles over the cross-blind.
"Look at the young scamps after him. Show where?"
Lenehan cried, running to the window.
"A street cortege."
Both smiled over the cross-blind at the file of capering newsboys in Mr. Bloom's wake, the last zigzagging white on the breeze, a mocking kite, a tail of white bow knots.
"Look at the young gutter snipe behind him hue and cry," Lenehan said. "And you'll kick all my rib-risible, taken off his flat spogs, and the walk, small nines, steal upon larks."
He began to mazurka in swift caricature across the floor, on sliding feet, past the fireplace to J.J. O'Molloy, who placed the tissues in his receiving hands.
"What's that?"
Miles Crawford said with a start.
"Where did the other two gone?"
"Who?" the professor said, turning.
"They've gone round to the Oval for a drink. Paddy Hooper is there with Jack Hall. Came over last night." "Come on, then,"
Miles Crawford said.
"Where's my hat?"
He walked jerkily into the office behind, parting the vent of his jacket, jingling his keys in his back pocket. They jingled then in the air and against the wood as he locked his desk drawer. "He's pretty well on," Professor McHugh said in a low voice.
"Seems to be,"
J.J. O'Molloy said, taking out a cigarette case in murmuring meditation. "But it is not always as it seems. Who has the most matches?"
"The Calumet of Peace."
He offered a cigarette to the professor and took one himself. Lenehan promptly struck a match for them and lit their cigarettes in turn. J.J. O'Molloy opened his case again and offered it.
"Thank ye, Vuz,"
Lenehan said, helping himself. The editor came from the inner office, a straw hat on his brow. He declaimed in song, pointing sternly at Professor McHugh. "'Twas rank and fame that tempted thee, 'twas empire charmed thy heart.'" The professor grinned, locking his long lips.
"Hey, you bloody old Roman Empire!"
Miles Crawford said. He took a cigarette from the open case. Lenehan, lighting it for him with quick grace, said,
"Silence for my brand new riddle!"
"Imperium Romanum," J.J. O'Molloy said gently. "It sounds nobler than British or Brixton. The word reminds one somehow of fat in the fire." Miles Crawford blew his first puff violently towards the ceiling.
"That's it," he said. "We are the fat. You and I are the fat in the fire. We haven't got a chance of a snowball in hell. The grandeur that was Rome."
"Wait a moment," Professor McHugh said, raising two quiet claws. "We mustn't be led away by words, by sounds of words. We think of Rome imperial, imperious, imperative." He extended elocutionary arms from frayed, stained shirt cuffs, pausing. "What was the civilization?"
"Vast, I allow, but vile. Cloacae, sewers. The Jews in the wilderness and on the mountaintop said, 'It is meet to be here. Let us build an altar to Jehovah.' The Roman, like the Englishman who follows in his footsteps, brought to every new shore on which he set his foot, on our shore he never set it, only his cloacal obsession. He gazed about him in his toga, and he said, 'It is meet to be here. Let us construct a water closet.'"
"Which they accordingly did do," Lenehan said. "Our old ancient ancestors, as we read in the first chapter of Guinness's, were partial to the running stream."
"They were nature's gentlemen," J.J. O'Molloy murmured. "But we also have Roman law."
"And Pontius Pilate is its prophet," Professor McHugh responded. "Do you know that story about Chief Baron Palais?" J.J. O'Molloy asked. "It was at the Royal University dinner. Everything was going swimmingly."
"First, my riddle," Lenehan said. "Are you ready?"
Mr. O'Madden Burke, tall in copious grey of Donegal tweed, came in from the hallway. Stephen Dedalus behind him, uncovered as he entered.
"Entrez, mes enfants," Lenehan cried. "I escort a suppliant," Mr. O'Madden Burke said melodiously. "Youth, led by experience, visits notoriety."
"How do you do?" the editor said, holding out a hand. "Come in, your governor's just gone."
Lenehan said to all, "Silence. What opera resembles a railway line? Reflect, ponder, excogitate, reply."
Stephen handed over the typed sheets, pointing to the title and signature.
"Who?"
the editor asked, a bit torn off.
"Mr. Garrett Deasy,"
Stephen said.
"That owl pelters," the editor said. "Who tore it? Was he sure taken? On swift sail flaming from storm and south, he comes pale vampire mouth to my mouth."
"Good day, Stephen," the professor said, coming to peer over their shoulders.
"Foot and mouth? Are you turned?"
"Bullock befriending bard."
"Shindy in well-known restaurant."
"Good day, sir," Stephen answered, blushing. "The letter is not mine. Mr. Garrett Deasy asked me to—"
"Oh, I know him," Miles Crawford said. "And you his wife, too. The bloodiest old tartar God ever made. By Jesus, she had the foot-and-mouth disease, no mistake. The night she threw the soup in the waiter's face in the Staring Garter. Oh-hoo!"
"A woman brought sin into the world. For Helen, the runaway wife of Menelaus, 10 years, the Greeks, O'Rourke, Prince of Breffni."
"Is he a widower?" Stephen asked. "Aye, a grass one,"
Miles Crawford said, his eye running down the typescript. Emperor's horses, Habsburg, an Irishman saved his life on the ramparts of Vienna, don't you forget. Maximilian Carol O'Donnell, Graf von Tyrconnell in Ireland. Send his heir over to make the king an Austrian field marshal now. Going to be trouble there one day. Wild geese, oh yes, every time. Don't you forget that. The moot point is, did he forget it? J.J. O'Molloy said quietly, turning a horseshoe paperweight. Saving princes is a thank you job. Professor McHugh turned on him. And if not, he said.
I'll tell you how it was, Miles Crawford began. A Hungarian it was, one day.
Lost causes. Noble Marquis mentioned.
We were always loyal to lost causes, the professor said. Success for us is the death of the intellect and of the imagination. We were never loyal to the successful. We served them. I teach the blatant Latin language. I speak the tongue of a race, the acme of whose mentality is the maxim. Time is money, material domination, dominus, lord. Where is the spirituality? Lord Jesus, Lord Salisbury, a sofa in a West End club. But the Greek?
Kyrie eleison!
A smile of light brightened his dark-rimmed eyes, lengthened his long lips.
The Greek, he said again. Kyrios, shining word. The vowels the Semite and the Saxon know not. Kyrie, the radiance of the intellect. I ought to profess Greek, the language of the mind. Kyrie eleison, the closet maker and the cloaca maker, will never be lords of our spirit. We are liege subjects of the Catholic chivalry of Europe that founded at Trafalgar and of the Empire of the Spirit, not an imperium that went under with the Athenian fleet at Aegospotami. Yes, yes, they went under. Pyrrhus, misled by an oracle, made a last attempt to retrieve the fortunes of Greece, loyal to a lost cause. He strode away from them towards the window.
They went forth to battle, Mr. O'Madden Burke said greyly, but they always fell.
Boo-hoo! Lenehan wept with a little noise, owing to a brick receipt in the latter half of the matinee. Poor Pyrrhus!
He whispered then near Stephen's ear.
Lenehan's limerick!
There's a ponder responded McHugh, who wears goggles of ebony hue. As he mostly sees double, to wear them white trouble, I can't see the Joe Miller, can you? In mourning for Sullust, Mulligan says, whose mother is beastly dead.
Miles Crawford crammed the sheets into a side pocket.
That'll be all right, he said. I'll read the rest after. That'll be all right.
Lenehan extended his hands in protest.
But my riddle, he said. What opera is like a railway line?
Opera? Mr. O'Madden Burke's sphinx face re-riddled. Lenehan announced gladly,
The Rose of Castile. See the wheeze? Rose of cast steel. Gee!
He poked Mr. O'Madden Burke mildly in the spleen. Mr. O'Madden Burke fell back with grace on his umbrella, feigning a gasp.
Help! He sighed. I feel a strong weakness.
Lenehan, rising to tiptoe, fanned his face rapidly with the rustling tissues. The professor, returning by way of the files, swept his hand across Stephen's and Mr. O'Madden Burke's loose ties.
Paris, past and present, he said. You look like communards.
Like fellows who had blown up the Bastille, J.J. O'Molloy said in quiet mockery.
Or was it you shot the Lord Lieutenant of Finland between you? You look as though you'd done the deed, General Bobrikov.
Omnium gatherum!
We were only thinking about it, Stephen said.
All the talents! Miles Crawford said. Law, the classics, the turf, Lenehan put in. Literature, the press. If Bloom were here, the professor said, the gentle art of advertisement.
And Madame Bloom, Mr. O'Madden Burke added, the vocal muse, Dublin's prime favourite.
Lenehan gave a loud cough.
Ahem, he said very softly. Oh, for a fresh of breath air. I caught a cold in the park. The gate was open. You can do it!
The editor laid a nervous hand on Stephen's shoulder.
I want you to write something for me, he said. Something with a bite in it. You can do it. I see it in your face, in the lexicon of youth.
See it in your face, see it in your eye, lazy, idle little schemer.
Foot and mouth disease, the editor cried in scornful invective. Great nationalist meeting in Boris and Ossory, all balls, bulldozing the public. Give them something with a bite in it. Put us all into it, damn it, soul. Father, Son and Holy Ghost and Jakes McCarthy.
We can all supply mental pablum. Mr. O'Madden Burke said. Stephen raised his eyes to the bold, unheeding stare.
He wants you for the press gang, J.J. O'Molloy said. The Great Gallagher! You can do it,
Miles Crawford repeated, clenching his hand in emphasis. Wait a minute. We'll paralyze Europe, as Ignatius Gallagher used to say when he was on the Shockron, doing billiard marking in the Clarence. Gallagher, that was the pressman for you. That was a pen. You know how he made his mark, I tell you. That was the smartest piece of journalism ever known. That was in 81, 6th of May, time of the Invincibles, murder in the Phoenix Park. Before you were born, I suppose. I'll show you. He pushed past them to the files. Look at here, he said, turning. The New York World cable for a special. Remember that time? Professor McHugh nodded. New York World, the editor said excitedly, pushing back his straw hat. Where it took place. Tim Kelly, or Kavanaugh, I mean, Joe Brady and the rest of them. Where Skin the Goat drove the car. Whole route. See? Skin the Goat, Mr. O'Madden Burke said. Fitzharris. He has that cabman shelter, they say, down there at Butt Bridge. Holohan told me. You know Holohan. Hop and carry one, is it? Miles Crawford said. And poor Gumbly is down there too, so he told me, minding stones for the corporation, a night watchman. Stephen turned in surprise. Gumbly, he said. You don't say so. A friend of my father, is he? Never mind Gumbly, Miles Crawford cried angrily. Let Gumbly mind the stones. See, they don't run away. Look at here. What did Ignatius Gallagher do? I'll tell you. Inspiration of genius. Cabled right away. Have you Weekly Freeman of the 17th of March? Right. Have you got that? He flung back pages of the files and stuck his finger on a point. Take page 4, advertisement for Branson's coffee, let us say. Have you got that? Right. The telephone whirred. A distant voice. I'll answer it, the professor said, going. B is Parkgate. Good. His finger leaped and stuck point after point, vibrating. T is Viceregal Lodge. C is where murder took place. K is Knockmaroon Gate. The loose flesh of his neck shook like a cock's wattles. An ill-starched dickie jutted up, and with a rude gesture, he thrust it back into his waistcoat. Hello? Evening Telegraph here. Hello? Who's there? Yes. Yes? Yes. F to P is the route Skin the Goat drove the car for an alibi. Inchicore, Round Town, Windy Arbor, Palmerston Park, Renler, F-A-B-P. Got that? X is Davies Public House in Upper Leeson Street. The professor came to the inner door. Bloom is at the telephone, he said. Tell her to go to hell, the editor said promptly. X is Brooks Public House. See?
Clever. Very.
Clever, Lenehan said. Very.
Gave it to them on a hot plate, Miles Crawford said. The whole bloody history.
Nightmare from which you will never awake.
I saw it, the editor said proudly. I was present. Dick Adams, the best-hearted bloody corkman the Lord ever put the breath of life in, and myself.
Lenehan bowed to a shape of air, announcing, Madam, I'm Adam, and able was I ere I saw Elba.
History! Miles Crawford cried. The old woman of Princes Street was there first. There was weeping and gnashing your teeth over that, out of an advertisement. Gregor Grey made the design for it. That gave him the leg up. Then Paddy Hooper worked Tay Pay, who took him onto the Star. Now he's got in with Blumenfeld. That's press. That's talent. Pyatt, he was all their daddies.
The father of scare journalism, Lenehan confirmed, and the brother-in-law of Chris Callanan.
Hello? Are you there?
Yes, he's here still. Come across yourself. Where did you find a pressman like that now, eh?
The editor cried. He flung the pages down.
Clamdever, Lenehan said to Mr. O'Madden Burke. Very smart, Mr. O'Madden Burke said.
Professor McHugh came from the inner office.
Talking about the Invincibles, he said, did you see that some hawkers were up before the recorder?
Oh, yes.
J.J. O'Malloy said eagerly. Lady Duddy was walking home through the park to see all the trees that were blown down by the cyclone last year and thought she'd buy a view of Dublin, and it turned out to be a commemoration postcard of Joe Brady or Number One or Skin the Goat right outside the Viceregal Lodge.
Imagine! They're only in the hook and eye department, Miles Crawford said. Pshaw! Press on the bar. Where have you a man now at the bar like those fellows, like Whiteside, like Isaac Butt, like Silver-Tongued O'Hagan, eh? Ah, bloody nonsense. Only in the halfpenny place.
His mouth continued to twitch, unspeaking, in nervous curls of disdain. Would anyone wish that mouth for her kiss? How do you know? Why did you write it then?
Rhymes and Reasons.
Mouth south. Is the mouth south some way? Or the south the mouth? Must be some south, pout, out, shout, drought. Rhymes. Two men dressed the same, looking the same, two by two. La tua pace, che parla di piace, mentre che il vento, come fa si tace. He saw them three by three, approaching girls, in green, in rose, in russet, entwining, per lei ha perso, in mauve, In purple, quella pacifica oria fiamma, in gold of oriflamme, the rimera fe più ardenti. But I, old men, penitent, leaden-footed, under dark neath the night, mouth, south, tomb, womb.
Speak up for yourself, Mr. O'Maddenburg said.
Sufficient for the day!
J.J. O'Molloy, smiling palely, took up the gauge. My dear Miles, he said, flinging his cigarette aside, you put a false construction on my words. I hold no brief, as at present advised, for the third profession qua profession, but your cork legs are running away with you. Why not bring in Henry Grattan, and Flood, and Demosthenes, and Edmund Burke? Ignatius Gallo, we all know, and his chapel is at Boss Harmsworth of the Farthing Press, and his American cousin of the Bowery Gutter of Sheet, not to mention Paddy Kelly's budget, Pew's occurrences, and our watchful friend the Skipperine Eagle. Why bring in a master of forensic eloquence like Whiteside? Sufficient for the day is the newspaper thereof.
Links with bygone days of yore. Grattan and Flood wrote for this very paper, the editor cried in his face. Irish volunteers, where are you now? Established 1763, Dr. Lucas, who have you now like John Philpot Curtin? Pshaw!
Well, J.J. O'Molloy said, Bush K.C., for example.
Bush? The editor said. Well, yes, Bush, yes. He has a strain of it in his blood. Kendall Bush, or I mean Seymour Bush.
He would have been on the bench long ago, the professor said, only for... but no matter. J.J. O'Molloy turned to Stephen and said quietly and slowly, one of the most polished periods I think I ever listened to in my life fell from the lips of Seymour Bush. It was that case of fratricide, the child's murder case. Bush defended him, and in the porches of mine ear did pour. By the way, how did he find that out? He died in his sleep. Or the other story, Beast with Two Backs.
What was that?
The professor asked.
Italia magistra artium.
He spoke on the law of evidence, J.J. O'Molloy said, of Roman justice, as contrasted with the earlier Mosaic Code, the Lex Talionis, and he cited the Moses of Michelangelo in the Vatican.
Ha! A few well-chosen words, Lenehan prefaced. Silence!
Pause. J.J. O'Molloy took out a cigarette case. False lull. Something quite ordinary. Messenger took out his matchbox thoughtfully and lit his cigar. I have often thought since, on looking back over that strange time, that it was that small act, trivial in itself, that striking of that match, that determined the whole aftercourse of both our lives.
A polished period!
J.J. O'Molloy resumed, moulding his words. He said of it, that stony effigy in frozen music, horned and terrible, of the human form divine, that eternal symbol of wisdom and prophecy, which if aught that the imagination or the hand of sculptor has wrought in marble, of soul transfigured and of soul transfiguring, deserves to live. Deserves to live. His slim hand, with the wave, graced echo and fall.
Fine!
Miles Crawford said at once.
The divine afflatus, Mr. O'Madden Burke said.
You like it? J.J. O'Molloy asked Stephen. Stephen, his blood wooed by grace of language and gesture, blushed. He took a cigarette from the case. J.J. O'Molloy offered his case to Miles Crawford. Lenehan lit their cigarettes as before and took his trophy, saying,
Muchibus thankibus.
A man of high morale.
Professor McGinnis was speaking to me about you, J.J. O'Molloy said to Stephen. What do you think, really, of that hermetic crowd, the opal hush poets, A.E., the master mystic? That Blavatsky woman started it. She was a nice old bag of tricks. A.E. has been telling some Yankee interviewer that you came to him in the small hours of the morning to ask him about planes of consciousness. McGinnis thinks you must have been pulling A.E.'s leg. He is a man of the very highest morale, McGinnis. Speaking about me, what did he say? What did he say? What did he say about me? Don't ask.
No thanks, Professor McHugh said, waving the cigarette case aside. Wait a moment. Let me say one thing. The finest display of oratory I ever heard was a speech made by John F. Taylor at the College Historical Society. Mr. Justice Fitzgibbon, the present Lord Justice of Appeal, had spoken, and the paper under debate was an essay, new for those days, advocating the revival of the Irish tongue. He turned towards Miles Crawford and said, You know Gerald Fitzgibbon. Then you can imagine the style of his discourse.
He is sitting with Tim Healy, J.J. O'Molloy said, rumour has it, on the Trinity College Estates Commission.
"He is sitting with a sweet thing and a child's frock," Miles Crawford said. "Go on, well?"
"It was the speech, mark you," the professor said, "of a finished orator, full of courteous haughtiness and pouring in chastened diction. I will not say the vials of his wrath, but pouring the proud man's contumely upon the new movement. It was then a new movement. We were weak, therefore worthless." He closed his long, thin lips an instant, but eager to be on, raised an outspanned hand to his spectacles, and with trembling thumb and ring finger, touching lightly the black rims, steadied them to a new focus.
"Impromptu!"
In ferial tone, he addressed J.J. O'Molloy. Taylor had come there, you must know, from a sick bed. That he had prepared a speech, I do not believe, for there was not even one shorthand writer in the hall. His dark, lean face had a growth of shaggy beard round it. He wore a loose neckcloth, and altogether he looked, though he was not, a dying man. His gaze turned at once, but slowly, from J.J. O'Molloy's towards Stephen's face, and then bent at once to the ground, seeking. His unglazed linen collar appeared behind his bent head, soiled by his withering hair. Still seeking, he said, "When Fitzgibbon's speech had ended, John F. Taylor rose to reply. Briefly, as well as I can bring them to mind, his words were these." He raised his head firmly. His eyes bethought themselves once more. Witless shellfish swam in the gross lenses to and fro, seeking outlet. He began,
"Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, great was my admiration in listening to the remarks addressed to the youth of Ireland a moment since by my learned friend. It seems to me that I had been transported into a country far away from this country, into an age remote from this age, that I stood in ancient Egypt, and that I was listening to the speech of some high priest of that land addressed to the youthful Moses."
His listeners held their cigarettes poised to hear, their smoke ascending in frail stalks that flowered with his speech.
"And let our crooked smokes..."
"Noble words coming, look out. Could you try your hand at it yourself?"
"And it seemed to me that I heard the voice of that Egyptian high priest raised in a tone of like haughtiness and like pride. I heard his words, and their meaning was revealed to me. From the fathers.
It was revealed to me that those things are good which yet are corrupted, which neither, if they were supremely good, nor, unless they were good, could be corrupted."
"Ah, curse it, that's St. Augustine." "Why will you Jews not accept our culture, our religion, and our language? You are a tribe of nomad herdsmen, we are a mighty people. You have no cities, nor no wealth. Our cities are hives of humanity, and our galleys, trireme and quadrireme, laden with all manner merchandise, furrow the waters of the known globe. You have but emerged from primitive conditions. We have a literature, a priesthood, an age-long history, and a polity."
"Nile, child, man, effigy. By the Nile bank the babe Mary's kneel, cradle of bulrushes, a man supple in combat, stone-horned, stone-bearded, heart of stone.
You pray to a local and obscure idol. Our temples, majestic and mysterious, are the abodes of Isis and Osiris, of Horus and Amon-Ra. Yours, serfdom, awe and humbleness. Ours, thunder and the seas. Israel is weak, and few are her children. Egypt is an host, and terrible are her arms. Vagrants and day-laborers are you called. The world trembles at our name."
A dumb belch of hunger cleft his speech. He lifted his voice above it boldly.
"But, ladies and gentlemen, had the youthful Moses listened to and accepted that view of life, had he bowed his head and bowed his will and bowed his spirit before that arrogant admonition, he would never have brought the chosen people out of the house of bondage, nor followed the pillar of the cloud by day. He would never have spoken with the Eternal amid lightnings on Sinai's mountaintop, nor ever have come down with the light of inspiration shining in his countenance, and bearing in his arms the tables of the law, graven in the language of the outlaw."
He ceased and looked at them, enjoying silence.
"Ominous for him!"
J.J. O'Molloy said, not without regret, and yet he died without having entered the land of promise.
A sudden at the moment, though from lingering illness, often previously expectorated demise, Lenehan said, and with a great future behind him.
The troop of bare feet was heard rushing along the hallway and pattering up the staircase.
That is oratory, the professor said, uncontradicted.
Gone with the wind, host that Mulligan asked, and Tara of the Kings, miles of ears of porches. The tribune's words howled and scattered to the four winds. A people shouted within his voice, dead noise. Akasic records of all that ever anywhere, wherever was, love and laud him, me no more. I have money.
Gentlemen, Stephen said, as the next motion on the agenda paper, may I suggest that the House do now adjourn?
You take my breath away. Is it not perchance a French compliment? Mr. Madden Burke asked. "'Tis the army thinks, when the wine jug, metaphorically speaking, is most grateful in ye ancient hostelry. That it be, and hereby is resolutely resolved. All who are in favour say aye,' Lenin announced. "'The contrary, no. I declare it carried. To which particular boozing shed? My casting vote is Mooney's.'
He led the way, admonishing.
"'We will sternly refuse to partake of strong waters, will we not? Yes, we will not, by no manner of means.'
Mr. O'Madden Burke, following close, said with an ally's lunge of his umbrella,
"'Lay on, Macduff! Chip off the old block!'
the editor cried, slapping Stephen on the shoulder. "'Let us go! Where are those blasted keys?'
He fumbled in his pocket, pulling out the crushed type sheets.
"'Foot and mouth, I know, that'll be all right, that'll go in. Where are they? That's all right!'
He thrust the sheets back and went into the inner office.
"'Let us hope!'
J.J. O'Molloy, about to follow him in, said quietly to Stephen, "'I hope you will live to see it published.'
"'Miles, one moment.'
He went into the inner office, closing the door behind him.
"'Come along, Stephen,' the professor said. "'That is fine, isn't it? It has the prophetic vision. Fuit Ilium, the sack of windy Troy, kingdoms of this world, the masters of the Mediterranean, a fellaheen today.'
The first newsboy came pattering down the stairs at their heels and rushed out into the street, yelling,
"'Racing special!'
"'Dublin, I have much, much to learn.' They turned to the left along Abbey Street. "'I have a vision, too,' Stephen said.
"'Yes?'
the professor said, skipping to get into step. "'Crawford will follow.' Another newsboy shot past them, yelling as he ran,
"'Racing special!'
"'Dear dirty Dublin!'
"'Dubliners!' Two Dublin Vestals, Stephen said, elderly and pious, have lived 50 and 53 years in Fumbly's Lane.
Where is that?
The professor asked.
Off Black Pits.
Damp night, reeking of hungry dough, against the wall, face listening tallow under her fustian shawl, frantic hearts, Kasich records. Quicker, darling. On now, dare it. Let there be life.
They want to see the views of Dublin from the top of Nelson's Pillar. They save up 3 and 10 pence in a red tin letterbox money box. They shake out the 3-penny bits and a 6-pence and coax out the pennies with the blade of a knife. 2 and 3 in silver and 1 and 7 in coppers. They put on their bonnets and best clothes and take their umbrellas for fear it may come on to rain.
Wise virgins, Professor McHugh said. Life on the raw!
They buy 1 and 4 pence worth of brawn and 4 slices of pan loaf at the North City dining rooms in Marlborough Street from Miss Kate Collins, proprietress. They purchase 4 and 20 ripe plums from a girl at the foot of Nelson's Pillar to take off the thirst of the brawn. They give 2 3-penny bits to the gentleman at the turnstile and begin to waddle slowly up the winding staircase, grunting, encouraging each other, afraid of the dark, panting, one asking the other, "Have you the brawn?" Praising God and the Blessed Virgin, threatening to come down, peeping at the air slits. Glory be to God! They had no idea it was that high. Their names are Anne Cairns and Florence McCabe. Anne Cairns has the lumbago, for which she rubs on Lourdes water, given her by a lady who got a bottleful from a passionless father. Florence McCabe takes a crew bean and a bottle of XX for supper every Saturday.
Antithesis, the professor said, nodding twice. Vestal virgins. I can see them. What's keeping our friend?
He turned. A bevy of scampering newsboys rushed down the steps, scampering in all directions, yelling, their white papers fluttering. Hard after them, Miles Crawford appeared on the steps, his hat aureoling his scarlet face, talking with J.J. O'Molloy.
"'Come along!'
the professor cried, waving his arm. He set off again to walk by Stephen's side.
"'Return of Bloom!'
"'Yes,' he said. "'I see them.'
Mr. Bloom, breathless, caught in a whirl of wild newsboys near the offices of the Irish Catholic and Dublin Penny Journal, called,
"Mr. Crawford, a moment!
Telegraph! Racing special! What is it?"
Miles Crawford said, falling back a pace. A newsboy cried in Mr. Bloom's face,
"Terrible tragedy in Rathmines! A child bit by a bellows! Interview with the editor!"
"Just this ad," Mr. Bloom said, pushing through towards the steps, puffing and taking the cutting from his pocket. "I spoke with Mr. Keyes just now. He'll give a renewal for 2 months, he says, after he'll see. But he wants a power to call attention in the Telegraph too, the Saturday Pink. And he wants it, if it's not too late, I told Councillor Nannetti, from the Kilkenny People. I can have access to it in the National Library. House of Keyes, don't you see? His name is Keyes. It's a play on the name, but he practically promised he'd give the renewal, but he wants just a little puff. What'll I tell him, Mr. Crawford?"
"KMA! Will you tell him he can kiss my arse?" Miles Crawford said, throwing out his arm for emphasis. "Tell him that straight from the stable."
"A bit nervy. Look out for squalls. All off for a drink. Arm in arm." Lenehan's yachting cap on the cadge beyond. Usual blarney. "Wonder is that young Dedalus the moving spirit? Has a good pair of boots on him today. Last time I saw him, he had his heels on view. Been walking in muck somewhere. Careless chap. What was he doing in Irish Town?" "Well," Mr. Bloom said, his eyes returning, "if I can get the design, I suppose it's worth a short power. He'd give the ad, I think. I'll tell him."
"KMRIA! He can kiss my Royal Irish arse!"
Miles Crawford cried loudly over his shoulder.
"Any time he likes, tell him!"
While Mr. Bloom stood weighing the point and about to smile, he strode on jerkily.
"Raising the Wind. Another Borner, Jack," he said, raising his hand to his chin. "I'm up to here. I've been through the hoop myself. I was looking for a fella to back a bill for me no later than last week. You must take the will for the deed. Sorry, Jack, with a heart and a half, if I could raise the wind anyhow."
J.J. O'Molloy pulled a long face and walked on silently. They caught up on the others and walked abreast. When they have eaten the brawn and the bread, and wiped their 20 fingers in the paper the bread was wrapped in, they go nearer to the railings. "Something for you," the professor explained to Miles Crawford. "Two old Dublin women on the top of Nelson's Pillar."
"Some column! That's what Wadlow once said."
"That's new," Miles Crawford said. "That's copy. Out for the waxies dargle. Two old trickies, what?"
"But they're afraid the pillar will fall," Stephen went on. "They see the roofs and argue about where the different churches are, Rathmines, Blue Dome, Adam and Eve, St. Lawrence of Tools, but it makes them giddy to look, so they pull up their skirts."
"Those slightly rambunctious females!"
"Easy all," Miles Crawford said. "No poetic license. We're in the archdiocese here."
And settled down on their striped petticoats, peering up at the statue of the one-handled adulterer.
"One-handled adulterer!" the professor cried. "I like that. I see the idea. I see what you mean."
"Dames donate Dublin sits. Speed pills, velocitas, aerolits, belief."
"It gives them a crick in their necks," Stephen said. "And they are too tired to look up or down or to speak. They put the bag of plums between them and eat the plums out of it one after another, wiping off with their handkerchief the plum juice that dribbles out of their mouths and spitting the plum stones slowly out between the railings." He gave a sudden loud young laugh as a close. Lenehan and Mr. O'Madden Burke, hearing, turned, beckoned and led on across towards Mooney's.
"Finished?" Miles Crawford said. "So long as they do no worse. Sophist, Wallops, Haughty Helen's, Square on Proboscis. Spartans, Nash Molars. Itharkins, Val Pen is Champ."
"You remind me of Antisthenes," the professor said, "a disciple of Gorgias, the sophist. It is said of him that none could tell if he were bitterer against others or against himself. He was the son of a noble and a bondwoman, and he wrote a book in which he took away the palm of beauty from Argive Helen and handed it to poor Penelope. Poor Penelope. Penelope Rich." They made ready to cross O'Connell Street.
"Hello there, Central!"
At various points along the 8 lines, tram cars with motionless trolleys stood in their tracks, bound for or from Rathmines, Rathfarnham, Blackrock, Kingstown and Dorkey, Sandymount Green, Ringsend and Sandymount Tower, Donnybrook, Palmerston Park and Upper Rathmines, all still becalmed in short circuit. Hackney cars, cabs, delivery wagons, mail vans, private brooms, aerated mineral water floats with rattling crates of bottles, rattled, rolled, horse-drawn, rapidly.
What? And likewise, where?
But what do you call it? Miles Crawford asked. Where do they get the plums?
Virgilian says pedagogue sophomore, plumps for old man Moses.
Call it, wait,
the professor said, opening his long lips wide to reflect. Call it, let me see, call it Deus Nobis Haec Otia Fecit.
No, Stephen said, I call it a Pishog site of Palestine, or the parable of the plums.
I see, the professor said. He laughed richly.
I see, he said again, with new pleasure. Moses and the Promised Land. We gave him that idea, he added to J.J. O'Molloy.
Horatio is cynosure this fair June day.
J.J. O'Molloy sent a weary sidelong glance towards the statue and held his peace.
I see,
the professor said. He halted on Sir John Gray's pavement island and peered aloft at Nelson through the meshes of his wry smile.
Diminished digits prove too titillating for frisky frumps. Anne Wimbles, Flo Wangles, yet can you blame them?
One-handled adulterer, he said grimly. That tickles me, I must say.
Tickled the old ones, too, Miles Crawford said, if the God Almighty's truth was known.
Pineapple rock, lemon plat, butterscotch. A sugar-sticky girl shoveling scoopfuls of creams for a Christian brother. Some school treat. Bad for their tummies. Lozenge and comfort manufacturer to His Majesty the King, God save our, sitting on his throne sucking red jujubes white. A somber YMCA young man, watchful among the warm sweet fumes of Graham lemons, placed a throwaway in a hand of Mr. Bloom. Heart-to-heart talks. Blue me? No. Blood of the Lamb. His slow feet walked him riverward, reading. Are you saved? All are washed in the blood of the Lamb. God wants blood victim. Birth, hymen, martyr, war, foundation of a building, sacrifice, kidney burnt offering, druid's altars. Elijah is coming. Dr. John Alexander Dowie, restorer of the church in Zion, is coming, is coming, is coming, is coming. All heartily welcome. Paying game. Tory and Alexander last year. Polygamy. His wife will put the stopper on that. Where was that ad? Some Birmingham firm. The luminous crucifix. Our saviour. Wake up in the dead of night and see him on the wall hanging. Pepper's ghost idea. Iron nails ran in. Phosphorus it must be done with. If you leave a bit of codfish, for instance. I could see the bluey silver over it. Night I went down to the pantry in the kitchen. Don't like all the smells in it waiting to rush out. What was it you wanted? The Malaga raisins. Thinking of Spain, before Rudy was born. The phosphorescence, that bluey, greeny, very good for the brain. From Butler's Monument House corner, he glanced along Bachelor's Walk. Dedalus's daughter there still outside Dylan's auction rooms. Must be selling off some old furniture. Knew her eyes at once from the father, lobbing about, waiting for him. Home always breaks up when the mother goes. 15 children he had. Birth every year, almost. That's in their theology, or the priest won't give the poor woman the confession, the absolution. Increase and multiply. Did you ever hear such an idea? Eat your outer house and home. No families themselves to feed, living on the fat of the land. Their butteries and larders. I'd like to see them do the black fast, Yom Kippur. Cross buns. One meal in a collation for fear he'd collapse on the altar. A housekeeper of one of those fellas, if you could pick it out of her. Never pick it out of her. Like getting LSD out of him. Does himself well. No guests, all for number one. Watching his water. Bring your own bread and butter. His reverence. Mum's the word. Good Lord. That poor child's dress is in flitters. Underfed she looks, too.
Potatoes and marge, marge and potatoes. It's after they feel it. Proof of the pudding undermines the constitution. As he set foot on O'Connell Bridge, a puffball of smoke plumed up from the parapet. Brewery barge with export stout. England. Sea air sours it, I heard. Be interesting some day get a pass through Hancock to see the brewery. Regular world in itself. Vats of porter. Wonderful. Rats get in, too. Drink themselves bloated as big as a collie floating. Dead drunk on the porter. Drink till they puke again like Christians. Imagine drinking that. Rats. Vats. Well, of course, if we knew all the things. Looking down, he saw flapping strongly, wheeling between the gaunt quay walls, gulls. Rough weather outside. If I threw myself down, Reuben J.'s son must have swallowed a good bellyful of that sewage. 1 8 too much. It's the droll way he comes out with the things. Knows how to tell a story, too. They wheeled lower, looking for grub. Wait. He threw down among them a crumpled paper ball. Elijah, 32 feet per sec, has come. Not a bit. The ball bobbed unheeded on the wake of swells, floated under by the bridge piers. Not such damn fools. Also, the day I threw that stale cake out of the Aaron's King, picked it up in the wake, 50 yards astern, live by their wits. They wheeled, flapping. The hungry, famished gull flaps o'er the waters dull. That is how poets write, the similar sounds. But then Shakespeare has no rhymes, blank verse, the flow of the language it is, the thoughts, solemn. Hamlet, I am thy father's spirit, doomed for a certain time to walk the earth.
2 apples a penny, 2 for a penny.
His gaze passed over the glazed apples serried on her stand. Australians they must be this time of year. Shiny peels, polishes them up with a rag or a handkerchief. Wait, those poor birds. He halted again and bought from the old apple woman 2 Banbury cakes for a penny, and broke the brittle paste and threw its fragments down into the liffey. See that? The gulls swooped silently, 2, then all, from their heights, pouncing on prey. Gone. Every morsel. Aware of their greed and cunning, he shook the powdery crumb from his hands. They never expected that. Manna. Live on fishy flesh they have to. All seabirds, gulls, sea goose. Swans from Analiffey swim down here sometimes to preen themselves. No accounting for tastes. Wonder what kind is swan meat? Robinson Crusoe had to live on them. They wheeled, flapping weakly. I'm not going to throw any more. Penny quite enough, not a thanks I get. Not even a caw. They spread foot and mouth disease, too. If you cram a turkey, say, on chestnut meal, it tastes like that. Eat pig, like pig. But then why is it that saltwater fish are not salty? How is that? His eyes sought answer from the river, and saw a rowboat rock at anchor on the treacly swells, lazily, its plastered board. Kinos, 11 shillings. Trousers. Good idea, that. Wonder if he pays rent to the corporation. How can you own water, really? It's always flowing in the stream, never the same, which in the stream of life we trace. Because life is a stream. All kind of places are good for ads. That quack doctor for the clap used to be stuck up in all the greenhouses. Never see it now. Strictly confidential. Dr. High Franks. Didn't cost him a red. Like McGinney the Dancing Master. Self-advertisement. Got fellas to stick them up, or stick them up himself for that matter, on the QT. Running in to loosen a button. Fly by night. Just the place, too. Post no bills. Post 110 pills. Some chap with a dose burning him. If he... Oh, eh? No, I don't believe it. He wouldn't, surely. No. Mr. Bloom moved forward, raising his troubled eyes. Think no more about that. After 1. Time ball on the ballast office is done. Done sink time. Fascinating little book, that is, of Sir Robert Ball's. Parallax. I never exactly understood. Well, there's a priest. Could ask him. Par, it's Greek. Parallel. Parallax. Metempsychosis, she called it, till I told her about the transmigration. Oh, rocks. Mr. Bloom smiled, oh, rocks, at 2 windows of the ballast office. She's right, after all. Only big words for ordinary things on account of the sound. She's not exactly witty. Can be rude, too. Blurt out what I was thinking. Still, I dunno. She used to say Ben Dollard had a bass barrel-tone voice. He has legs like barrels, and you think he was singing into a barrel. Now, isn't that wit?
They used to call him Big Ben. Not half as witty as calling him Bass Barrow, Tom. Appetite like an albatross. Get outside of a baron of beef. Powerful man he was, the story away, number one bass. Barrel of bass, see? It all works out. A procession of white-smocked men marched slowly towards him along the gutter, scarlet sashes across their boards. Bargains. Like that priest there this morning. We have sinned, we have suffered. He read the scarlet letters on their five tall white hats, H-E-L-Y-S, Wisdom Healy's. Y, lagging behind, drew a chunk of bread from under his foreboard, crammed it into his mouth, and munched as he walked. Our staple food. 3 bob a day, walking along the gutters, street after street. Just keep skin and bone together, bread and skilly. They're not boiled, no, middle-aged men. Doesn't bring in any business, either. I suggested to him about a transparent show cart with two smart girls sitting inside writing letters, copybooks, envelopes, blotting paper. I bet that would have caught on. Smart girls writing something catch the eye at once. Everyone dying to know what she's writing. Get 20 of them round you if you stare at nothing. Have a finger in the pie. Women, too. Curiosity. Pillar of salt. Wouldn't have it, of course, because he didn't think of it himself first. Or the ink bottle, I suggested, with a false stain of black celluloid. His ideas for ads, like plum trees potted under the obituaries, cold meat department. You can't lick him. What, our envelopes? Hello, Jones. Where are you going? Can't stop, Robinson. I'm hastening to purchase the only reliable ink eraser, Cancel, sold by Healy's Limited, 85 Dame Street. Well, out of that rook I am. Devil of a job it was collecting accounts of those convents. Tranquilla Convent. That was a nice nun there. Really sweet face. Wimple suited her small head. Sister... I'm sure she was crossed in love by her eyes. Very hard to bargain with, that sort of woman. I disturbed her at her devotions that morning, but glad to communicate with the outside world. Our great day, she said. Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Sweet name, too. Caramel. She knew, I think. She knew, by the way, if she had married, she would have changed. I suppose they really were short of money. Fried everything in the best butter all the same. No lard for them. My heart's broke, eaten, drippin'. They like buttering themselves in and out. Molly tasting it, her veil up. Sister Past Claffey, the pawnbroker's daughter. It was a nun, they say, invented barbed wire. He crossed Westmoreland Street when apostrophe S had plodded by. Rover Cycle Shop. Those races are on today. How long ago is that? Year Phil Gilligan died. We were in Lombard Street West. Wait, was in Tom's. Got the job in Wisdom Healy's the year we married. 6 years. 10 years ago. 94 he died. Yes, that's right. The big fire at Arnott's. Val Dillon was Lord Mayor. The Glencree dinner. Alderman Robert O'Reilly emptying the port into his soup before the flag fell. Bob Bob lapping it for the inner alderman. Couldn't hear what the band played. For what we have already received, may the Lord make us. Millie was a kiddie then. Molly had that elephant grey dress with the braided frogs, man-tailored with self-covered buttons. She didn't like it because I sprained my ankle first day she wore choir picnic at the Sugarloaf. As if that. Old Goodwin's tall hat done up with some sticky stuff. Fly's picnic, too. Never put a dress on her back like it. Fitted her like a glove, shoulder and hips, just beginning to plump it out well. Rabbit pie we had that day. People looking after her. Happy. Happier then. Snug little room, that was, with the red wallpaper. Dockrell's 1 and 9 pence a dozen. Millie's tubbing night. American soap I bought, elderflower. Cozy smell of her bath water. Funny she looked, soaped all over. Shapely, too. Now, photography. Poor Papa's daguerreotype atelier, he told me of. Hereditary taste. He walked along the curbstone. Stream of life. What was the name of that priestly-looking chap? Was always squinting in when he passed. Weak eyes, woman. Stopped in Citroën, St. Kevin's Parade. Pen something. Pen Dennis. My memory's getting... Pen. Of course, it's years ago. Noise of the trams, probably. Well, if he couldn't remember the day father's name that he sees every day... Bartle Darcy was the tenor just coming out then. Singer home after practice. Conceited fella with his waxed-up moustache. Gave her that song, Winds That Blow From the South. Windy night that was, I went to fetch her. There was that lodge meeting on, about those lottery tickets after Goodwin's concert in the supper room, or oak room, of the mansion house. He and I behind. sheet of her music blew out of my hand against the high school railings. Lucky it didn't. A thing like that spoils the effect of a night for her. Professor Goodwin linking her in front. Shaky on his pins, poor old sot. His farewell concerts, positively last appearance on any stage, maybe for months and maybe for never. Remember her laughing at the wind, her blizzard collar up. Corner of Harcourt Road, remember that gust? Boo-foo! Blew up all her skirts and her boa, nearly smothered old Goodwin. She did get flushed in the wind. Remember when we got home, raking up the fire, and frying up those pieces of lap of mutton for her supper with the chutney sauce she liked, and the mulled rum. Could see her in the bedroom from the hearth, unclamping the bust of her stays. White. Swish and soft flop, her stays made on the bed. Always warm from her. Always liked to let herself out. Sitting there after till near two, taking out her hairpins. Millie tucked up in Betty House. Happy. Happy. That was the night. Oh, Mr. Bloom, how do you do? Oh, how do you do, Mrs. Breen? No use complaining. How is Molly those times? Haven't seen her for ages. In the pink, Mr. Bloom said gaily. Millie has a position down in Mullingar, you know. Go away. Isn't that grand for her? Yes, and the photographer's there. Getting on like a house on fire. How are all your charges? All on the baker's list, Mrs. Breen said. How many has she? No other in sight. You're in black, I see. You have no... No, Mr. Bloom said. I've just come from a funeral. Going to crop up all day, I foresee. Who's dead, when, and what did he die of? Turn up like a bad penny. Oh, dear me, Mrs. Breen said. I hope it wasn't any near relation. May as well get her sympathy. Dignam, Mr. Bloom said. An old friend of mine. He died quite suddenly, poor fellow. Heart trouble, I believe. Funeral was this morning. Your funeral's tomorrow while you're coming through the rye. Diddle, diddle, dum, dum, diddle, diddle. Sad to lose the old friends, Mrs. Breen's woman eyes said melancholily. Now, that's quite enough about that. Just quietly, husband. And your lord and master? Mrs. Breen turned up her two large eyes. Hasn't lost them, anyhow. Oh, don't be talking, she said. He's a caution to rattlesnakes. He's in there now with his law books, finding out the law of libel. He has me heart scalded. Wait till I show you. Hot mock turtle vapour and steam of new-baked jam puffs roly-poly poured out from Harrison's. The heavy noon reek tickled the top of Mr. Bloom's gullet. Want to make good pastry, butter, best flour, demerara sugar, or they taste it with a hot tea. Or is it from her? A barefoot Arab stood over the grating, breathing in the fumes. Deadened the gnaw of hunger that way. Pleasure or pain, is it? Penny dinner, knife and fork chained to the table. Opening her handbag. Chipped leather, hatpin. Ought to have a guard on those things. Stick in a chap's eye in the tram. Rummaging. Open. Money. Please take one. Devils if they do sixpence. Raise Cain. Husband barging. Where's the 10 shillings I gave you on Monday? Are you feeding your little brother's family? Soiled handkerchief, medicine bottle. Pastille that was fell. What is she? There must be a new moon out, she said. He's always bad then. Do you know what he did last night? Her hands ceased to rummage. Her eyes fixed themselves on him, wide in alarm, yet smiling. What? Mr. Bloom asked. Let her speak. Look straight in her eyes. I believe you. Trust me. Woke me up in the night, she said. Dream he had. A nightmare. Indigest. Said the Ace of Spades was walking up the stairs. The Ace of Spades, Mr. Bloom said. She took a folded postcard from her handbag. Read that, she said. He got it this morning. What is it? Mr. Bloom asked, taking the card. U.P.?